Support for the Projection Booth podcast comes from Stitcher Smart Radio. Now podcast listeners can access the latest episodes of the Projection Booth and thousands of other podcasts on the go without downloading or syncing. Stitcher instantly delivers episodes of your favorite shows to your mobile phone. Stitcher Smart Radio can be found in the iPhone and Android app stores or on the web at stitcher.com/booth.
Summer in the city, back of my neck getting dirt and gritty. Bend down, isn't it a pity? Doesn't seem to be a shadow in the city. All around, people looking half dead, walking on the sidewalk harder than a match here. But at night, it's a different world. Go out and find a girl. Come on and dance all night. Despite the heat, it'll be alright. And babe, don't you know it's a pity? The days can't be like the nights in the summer. In the city, in the summer.
Welcome to another episode of the Projection Booth. I'm Rob St. Mary.
And I'm Mike White.
And hot damn this town, Detroit, Motown, sweltering hot. And from what I understand, Mike, other places outside of the city, also a little hot from what I understand.
Is there life outside Detroit, Rob?
Well, you know, they say there's life on Mars, but who knows?
I suppose there is Ann Arbor.
Yeah, that's right. The People's Republic of Ann Arbor, correct. Well, you know, as we talked about, the Corktown Cinema Barbecue was supposed to be happening on July 7th in, of all places, imagine that, Corktown area of Detroit, but it's not happening, at least not on July 7th. See, things have gone crazy here in the Midwest, especially in the Detroit area. We've had 100-degree days for the last several days. We've had power outage that's knocked out air conditioning to all kinds of folks, and there's a possibility that there could be some heavy storms again. So things have gone all crazy, and they've now delayed the Cinema Barbecue with the double feature of Equinox and Mothra to Saturday, July 14th. So if you're hearing this recording, you haven't missed out on your opportunity to make Projection Booth episode history here and come on down to the Cinema Barbecue on Saturday, July 14th for all the fun. So that's going to be great. If you can't join us in person, of course, you can be in spirit here with the magic of podcasting. We'll be dropping that episode like it's hot just a few days after the event.
We are going crazy from the heat, as David Lee Roth would say. So we'll also be dropping the American Hippie in Israel episode that same week, meaning that July is just going to be a wonderful time for Projection Boost listeners. You're getting all kinds of bonus just because of global warming and everything going to hell. But this week, not to take a week off, heaven forbid, we are bringing you a very special episode which features an interview with William Hortzberg, the screenwriter of The Georgia Peaches, Thunder and Lightning, Angel Heart, and Legend. I spoke to Mr. Hortzberg a little bit about these, but mostly about his latest book, Jubilee Hitchhiker, The Life and Times of Richard Brautigan. This is the definitive tome on Richard Brautigan, who just happens to be one of my favorite authors. So we're going to have more Brautigan coming up on a show in the future, which will coincide with, hopefully, the release of a documentary about him, as yet untitled. So be sure to visit our website for details, and we'll keep you up to date on that project as we go along throughout 2012 and possibly into 2013.
That's right. Our website, projection-booth.com, an invaluable source for all the information and a great place to leave us feedback and your thoughts on all the various shows that we do, or just to tell us that we suck or that we got it all wrong and the corn god is actually going to explain all of the weirdness of the universe to us through these series of codes and various other things and Jenga puzzle pieces and the records of Yoko Ono. So feel free, projection-booth.com, of course, Twitter, Facebook, all that fun stuff. Make sure to subscribe on iTunes. Leave us some feedback there as well. And we'll see you here in Detroit, Corktown Cinema, Cinema Barbecue double feature of Equinox and Mothra on July 14th.
So now, without any further ado, let's dive into the interview. We join it in progress as I shoot the breeze with Mr. Hortzberg about Thunder and Lightning.
I actually had to watch that movie a long time ago because I was doing a big article on Charles Williford.
Oh, all right, because right around the same time, I think they did Cockfighter with Warren Oates. Again, it was a Roger Corman deal. So
right, yeah, and he had a small part in Thunder and Lightning.
Warren Oates had a small part in Thunder and Lightning.
No, Charles Williford did.
Oh, Charles Williford, did he really? I didn't know that. What a compliment.
He was a bartender in it.
Oh, in the scene where the strippers are?
I think so.
There's a scene with the screenplay only belongs to the writer for the first draft. And then after that, you take notes and take your lumps, you know, and if you can't do it, then you're gone and they get someone else to do it instead. And so, you know, I've gotten a couple of credits that I'm very proud of because the credit is written by, and that means that the whole thing was mine from the original story right to the final polish, you know. I mean, you know, I did it all. And of course, I, you know, as always happens in these cases, I dismembered my original script, which was called Hog Heaven. It was more or less the same, except there were a couple of little tweakages that, you know, that they couldn't go with. For example, the scene where the young bootlegger is going after his girlfriend's father, who's the secret big bootlegger. You know, he goes to his home to confront him because he's just had his still all busted up by the guy's goons. And his wife says, oh, he's not here now. He's at his club meeting. And the next scene is at night in this open space with all these burning crosses. And the club meeting is a big Klan meeting. And the joke was, you know, because it was meant to be a comedy, the joke was that when everyone's wearing a hood, you don't know who's who. The young guy is wandering from one hooded figure, you know, trying to find, you know, this guy. So that was the initial joke. And then they just decided, since they were filming in the South, they just chickened out. They wouldn't do the Ku Klux Klan scene. And so they just said he's at his club meeting. The next thing you know, there are these bare-breasted strippers. But the dialogue is pretty much the same once he encounters the guy and they have a little face-off. But so that's how it goes. And, you know, I mean,
the line I remember the most from it was Charles Napier talking to David Carradine and threatening him by saying, like, and none of that kung fu shit.
Oh, right. Yeah, I threw that one in there just because, I mean, I thought it would get a cheap laugh. But the thing that I thought was my funniest moment was, I don't know, I thought the gag got stepped on by the director, because the scene was, the girl's in church, and so Harley, the hero, is going to go to this church and link up with her. And so he's outside, and you hear, like, there's a sermon in progress. Then you go inside, and the joke was that the preacher is delivering his sermon while wrestling an alligator in this kind of pit. But the thing is he goes inside, and he starts off with, like, a long shot. You know, you can't tell directors how to do stuff, so... But, I mean, if you were going to establish the joke, you'd hear the sermon as the guy is going in, voice over, and then you'd cut immediately a close-up in the pit of the preacher wrestling the alligator and shouting out, like, you know, get yourself a step over toehold on the Wily Serpent or whatever, and then cut back to the hero coming in and joining his girlfriend way in the back bleachers, and the preacher's now just a little small figure down there in the pit. But he didn't do that. So no one ever got the joke. I mean, no one quite realized by the, you know, that this was a weird church where the preacher wrestled alligators while preaching. It sounds funnier in hindsight than maybe it was meant to be, but it's the screenwriter's eternal complaint.
I do a magazine as well, and in the last issue, one of my frequent co-writers, he did a whole thing on Tanya Tucker, and there's a big blurb about George Peaches in there. Yeah.
Yeah, I never met Tanya Tucker, and I just rewrote that script, although, I mean, it got made after I rewrote it, and a lot of the stuff was put in by me. And in fact, one of my proudest moments is that Flashdance. Remember that movie Flashdance?
Mm-hmm.
That was a big hit. They lifted one of my, you know, a shot that I did very carefully describe, and they did shoot it as described, which is you start off seeing somebody welding, and there's a welder's mask, and there are all these sparks like flying around the welder. And then the torch is shut off, you know, and then the welder flips back the welder's mask, and it's this beautiful woman who's doing the welding. So that was exactly, that shot was just stolen from this little cheapo car chase movie of the week for CBS. It got appropriated. Nothing rare in that either, but Flashdance is probably a way better film than Georgia Peaches.
I don't know about that.
Well, maybe I don't. I've never seen Flashdance, except I've heard about the opening shot. People have, you know, I've seen it described. I said, hey, wait a minute. That was my shot. Well, I never met Tanya Tucker, but I did have lunch once with, and I'm trying to think, the gal that played the villain. She was nominated for an Academy Award in a movie called something like Elena, or, you know, where she played a Greek immigrant in New York. And she told me that when we had lunch, she was this kind of bosomy blonde. She told me that being in this film, this Georgia Peaches, had like absolutely changed her career. And I said, are you kidding me? You know, like a TV car chase thing changed your career? She said, no, I played the villain, and no one had ever taken me, you know, considered me for any serious roles before that. I was always the bimbo. But I played the villain. I played the villain, who's this sort of business, this cruel businesswoman. And after that, after people saw that, I was suddenly up for more. And then I got the part that I got an Academy nomination for. So I said, oh, well, great.
Was it Sally Kirkland?
That's right, Sally Kirkland. Thank you. The reason was, she was in this movie that McGuane wrote called Cold Feet that was shot in right here in Livingston back in the 80s. And so while she was there, somebody said, oh, you know, Sally Kirkland would love to have lunch with you. So I said, okay, you know. And so we went out to lunch, and that's what she told me. Kind of tickled me pink. You know, I said, wow. You know, and that was one of the big changes that I brought to my rewrite, was I took a conventional bad guy business villain and thought, well, it might be interesting, since we have two the heroes are both women to some extent, you know, let's have the villain be a woman, you know, this high powered woman. So
I need to know more about Jubilee Hitchhiker. When did you decide to embark on this?
Well, I signed a contract with a New York publisher in 1991. And that's when I started. And the next 10 years, although I took time out to work on some films, and I wrote a novel called Nevermore during that time. And even then, I was not finished with the research. In fact, I was still doing eBay, you know, online interviews with people the final week of production. I mean, it was about to go to press. And I was still revising and changing stuff and calling people up. And so that was just would have been like literally, because they can make a book now. I swear to God, they can make them in 3 weeks or something, 2 weeks from start to, I mean, I'm a creature of the Gutenberg era, so I didn't realize how fast, when it's all set digitally, how fast they can produce them. So I didn't start writing it really until somewhere around 2000. And even then, I would stop here and there. You know, I'd stall on something, and I worked on a couple of films, and I have a couple of novels I started during that period, but I have to, but put aside when I renewed my energy for, but anyway, so, but the bulk of my writing life for the past decade has been to write this book.
So what was it that finally kind of tipped the scales? What was the moment where you said, I really need to write this book about Brodigan?
I had a publisher in New York, and about 9 years went by, and they were wondering what was happening. So I figured I better at least have some pages to show them. So I started in, even though I knew I was not anywhere done with the research, but I did his childhood first, so I had most of the early stuff taken care of. So I figured I can just launch into it and keep doing interviews as I move along, and that's exactly what I did.
I meant even before that, like before you signed the contract, or what made you kind of, you know, pitch this to your publisher as far as...
I never did pitch them. I was offered it. I was offered, you know, they came to me, and I think it had something to do with the fact that another writer had the assignment for actually a very different publisher, and the publisher in New York, in the end, would not do the book. They said it was too big, too long, and I wanted them to do it as two separate volumes, like the way Elvis got two volumes, but they weren't interested in that, and they weren't interested in any of it. So finally, there was a big fight over whether or not, about the advance, and when that got settled, Counterpoint, which is a distinguished but much smaller press in Berkeley, was just waiting in the wings, and their one caveat was no two volumes. We don't care how big it is, it just has to all be in one volume. So that was I said, fine, that's okay. You know, the thing that's ironic is, no matter how big it is, I cut 800 pages out of the manuscript in the course of doing it, so it could have been a lot bigger. Anyway, so I think I got the nod, because when the first guy who signed on to do it, and he's a friend of mine, you know, got a sense of what he was in for, he just didn't think he had enough life, you know. He was wiser than I was. He knew how enormous it was going to be, and so he just backed off. And then they came to me, and partly because I guess I was a friend of Richard's, you know, and knew him, which was to an advantage because it helped open a bunch of doors when I was trying to get the interviews lined up.
Yeah, what was it like kind of talking about yourself in the third person as you were writing it?
Well, you know, it was one of those decisions I had to make right away because I also talk about myself in the first person. So I realized that, you know, and I put a paragraph of explanation in, I think, right in the second chapter to say, well, you know, it's weird because the author is also a character in the story, and there are times when I'm just a background, you know, I'm just an extra, a background action. But there are some little moments when, you know, it was sort of a personal one-on-one experience with Richard, and in those cases, I refer to myself as I. So in a weird way, the book is partly a memoir, but in a very small part. All of my stuff has been kind of hybrid amalgamations of things, if you know what I mean. It's, you know, I mean, Falling Angel wasn't strictly a detective story, and it wasn't really all horror. It was something in between. So I've always kind of, you know, played around with genre, so I guess I played around with the very notion of what a biography should be. But I think I played it straight because God knows I spent hundreds and hundreds of hours in the Bancroft Library reading microfilm and poring over, you know, I think I've read just about every word Richard ever wrote, published and unpublished. So I did do my scholarly homework to some degree, but never again, you know. From now on, it's all robots and witches and vampires for me, if you know what I mean. It's like, you know, it's something I can make up.
Right. Was this your first nonfiction, or had you written nonfiction before?
I've written nonfiction before, but only to the tune of, like, Sports Illustrated articles. I took time out from the book to do a cover story for Men's Journal on Dennis Quaid. You know, that's a lot less serious form of writing nonfiction than doing a biography or a real work of history where you basically have to back everything up with at least a couple of witnesses. It was a lot bigger deal than I'd ever imagined when I got started. And then once I was into it, I just didn't want to let go. I thought, God, I could just ditch it. Then I would have thrown away all this part of my life that I've worked on it. And I didn't want to do that either.
I mean, I can't imagine dedicating so much time to any one project. I mean, I've come close.
It's nuts,
stuff,
isn't it?
Yeah.
It's nuts. You know, you never know when you get rolling on, you know, where your path will take you. And I've pretty much I've not been a careerist in the extent that, you know, to the extent certainly that Richard was. And I didn't really know what I would do next. And perhaps that's been to my detriment because there's no neat pigeonhole where you can talk about my work because, you know, I've done things that are called science fiction, although I don't think of myself, I don't even read science fiction, you know, it's just, I like to think I'm shooting for literature, and so I'm just doing it in my own wacky way, and because every book has been different, had I been more of a careerist, I probably would have done it not that way. But what can I say, you know, I'm nudging myself into geezerhood here, and so I'm not going to stop now. You know, my next big novel, I'm going to do a little novella. I wrote a novella during that period of wrangling with the New York publisher about the advance, and that took almost a year. So I wrote a novella, and, you know, my agent is sort of like waiting for the results to come fully in on the biography and then trying to push that. And I have another idea for a little horror story novella that I probably will do next, just because I don't want to launch into something long. But one of the two novels I started in the course of all of this Richard stuff is set in the Middle Ages. It does revolve a little research, but mostly looking at pictures. You know, like that's the kind of research I like, looking at pictures. And so I'll probably go back to that, but that could be another 800-pager by the time I'm done. So I thought I'd take some time off and try to write some short stuff first, just because it's knowing that I can be done in 4 or 5 months or 6 months is a great relief.
Right, instead of 20 years or whatever.
Yeah, and this novella was a great experiment for me because for the first time in my life, I wrote it longhand in notebooks, and I'd never written longhand. I always thought I needed to see, you know, the type on the page or on the screen, so it would give me an approximation of what it would look like as a book. But I suddenly, you know, found that it just flowed right out of me, and I really had a ton of fun. It's a little thriller, you know, set in Mexico in the 60s, and I like to say it's awash in blood, sex, and drugs. and so anyway, so it just flowed right out, and I had a great time doing it. And so I thought, well, I'll try that again, because it's how fun is that? That all, you know, you have your little notebook and you have your little pen, and you can just operate anywhere. You can just sit in the back booth of some cafe and scribble away to your heart's content.
You think that was maybe influenced by seeing all the notebooks that Brautigan used to write in?
Well, it could have been. You know, Richard wrote everything longhand just about, for the, you know, in its first draft. Often there were poems written on cocktail napkins when he was dead drunk. And he's even published a couple of poems where, you know, like he's going along and all of a sudden there's two blank lines and he has in parentheses, well, there are two more lines to this poem, but I can't read my own writing, so I'm leaving them blank.
How many people did you talk to over the whole?
I think about 150 total.
Wow.
Yeah, I have hundreds of hours of tape. That was really one of the most fun parts of it was, you know, I met a lot of people whose work I'd admired since college days or earlier. I mean, like people like Robert Creeley and Philip Whalen, Gary Snyder, you know, just, it was very, you know, it was very much fun. And the sad thing, unfortunately for me, was I took so long to get the book finished. Many of these people are now gone. You know, like Phil and Bob Creeley, and I really wanted them to be able to read the book. Ed Dorn, you know, they're just not here anymore, and but they're in the book, and if there's a library in heaven, maybe they can check it out.
Who was your toughest to get?
I'm sort of doing an online interview off and on in bits and pieces with a guy from this magazine in England called Beat Scene. Do you know of that magazine? He wanted to know who was my first interview and stuff, and I said, well, you'll have to wait till I get back up to my cabin, which will be towards the end of this week, because I have these little red day books that I mostly jot down expenses in, and what I do, you know, in a kind of quote-unquote businessy way. And so if I went back to my, like, 1991 little red day book, you know, I could see who it was, but I suspect it was Richard's mother. Was my first real interview, and she was very tough to get in that she would never answer her phone. And I was living in a motel in Eugene, Oregon, and I knew she was living there, and I would drive past, and, you know, sometimes in the evening I'd see lights on, and she would never, the phone would ring and ring, and finally I just said, well, what the hell, you know, I went out and I bought 24 roses, and I just marched right up to the front door and rang the doorbell, and she opened up the doorbell, and I gave her the flowers and told her what I wanted, and that was the beginning of maybe 10 interviews where, you know, she was great. I mean, she just would talk and talk and talk. I got more out of her than Richard ever did, that's for sure. And another tough one was Ken Kesey, who was working on something, and he just lived right across the river in Springfield, and I kept wanting to go over and sit down with him, but I kept getting Faye, his wife, who would, like, you know, fend me off. And finally one day, you know, the phone, it was Kesey, you know, himself on the phone. And I just, you know, I gave my usual little spiel about how I'd love to come, you know, I wanted to do this book about Richard. And he goes, got a pencil? And I said, well, yeah. And then the next thing I know, I'm doing the interview on the phone, you know, with a pencil and in a notebook. So that, anyway, so I could say that was tough because he kept, you know, basically avoiding me. And another really, really tough one, and I don't know if it even counts as an interview, was Ferlinghetti. And Ferlinghetti, who actually published Richard in, you know, the City Lights Journal, he wouldn't talk to me, and his people kept, it just wouldn't happen. And I can't say for a fact, but I think in part it was because Ferlinghetti didn't really like Richard's work very much. I wonder if I should say this, because I can make a lot of enemies, but what the hell, the guy's 90 years old, so how hard can he punch, right? So, I mean, I think Richard is, like, infinitely a better writer than Lawrence Ferlinghetti, so that's the joke for me, you know, like, here's this guy, who, you know, the Grand Poobah, the Poet Laureate of San Francisco, and so he's fending me off because he doesn't want to be quoted saying negative things about Richard, which is fine enough, but they did a thing at Naropa. It's this Buddhist school in Boulder, Colorado, the Trungpa Rinpoche. Anyway, it's a long, long story, but it's this kind of Buddhist school, and there was, you know, it was sort of founded in a way. The Beats were early connected. The English program there, the writing program, was called something like the Jack Kerouac School of Disembodied Poetics. I mean, there's no more self-congratulatory group on the planet than all these old Beats, you know. I mean, my God, they are self-promoters. And anyway, and actually, Ferlinghetti said, like, the Beats would not have existed. There would be no such thing as the Beat Generation if it hadn't been for Allen Ginsberg, who was their, you know, he was their notorious champion. All these people were his friends, Kerouac, Corso, everybody, you know. And he was just relentless in trying to promote their work. And sure enough, you know, he succeeded. Anyway, so they were dedicating a new library. It was going to be called the Allen Ginsberg Memorial Library, you know, and there was this big to-do about it. And I knew they'd all be there, you know, they'd all be there. So they were. So I managed to finagle a press pass. And, they all gave press conferences. I mean, if you can imagine Gregory Corso giving a press conference, but yes, indeed, they were all out there, you know, basking in their beatitude. And so there I was when Ferlinghetti gave his press conference, and every time I raised my hand, he didn't know me from Adam, you know, so he'd call on me and I'd ask him a question about Richard Brautigan. And he'd answer, you know, and then I got him on tape. Not much, but a few quotes came down on tape. And Ginsberg himself was another tough nut. I introduced him at a poetry reading in Billings once, and spent the day with him. We went and had lunch. He wanted to visit a ranch, and a mutual friend, and you know, set us up with his luncheon and invitation to a sheep ranch. And we drove out to the ranch together, and we were in each other's company like all day long. And so I had my tape recorder. I figured here's where I, you know, because I knew he'd known Richard. And when I tried to talk to him about it, he just said, and I was just getting started. I mean, this was in the early '90s, and he said, "Well, I didn't really know Richard all that well, so I haven't got much to say." So I just took him at face value, you know. I mean, what are you going to do, say, "No, you lying bastard, I happen to know." But I didn't, you know. So, but then as it come to find out, as I, you know, as the research deepened, and by this time Ginsberg was dead, you know, that he knew him way better than, you know, than he had let on. He'd even mopped up his vomit once in his little apartment in the East Village. And but the thing was is that he didn't respect him. And you know, I found a hand-drawn birthday card from Allen Ginsberg to Richard, in which Allen Ginsberg had done this drawing, kind of, it's all Tibetan Book of the Dead-ish stuff. I don't think he respected Richard as a writer. And I know for a fact that he made fun of him behind his back and pinned a couple of different pejorative nicknames on him. And so that's all in the book, you know, I mean, because I heard about it from reputable sources, and you know, so that's why he didn't want to go on record officially as to, you know, putting Richard down, which is noble in its own way, I would say.
I was really glad that you included the story of trying to get Richard's father to talk to you.
Well, that's because it became a story. You know, I tried 3 or 4 times and had him hang up the phone on me and have him slam the door in my face, and then to have it end with him just saying, "Oh, you know, come on out and let's, you know, talk. And do you mind if I turn on the tape recorder?" Hell no, you know, and then there it was. So it had you know, that was good, you know. I scooped everybody, I think. Not that this is like, you know, stop the presses, but still, you know, I mean, it was this guy's side of the story that he never gave out to anybody else. And whether he's really Richard's father or not, who can say? There's no DNA testing going on now, and the guy is long dead. And I tried to leave it that way. You know, he did look physically like Richard, but he was very tiny, and Mary Lou was very tiny, and Richard was a giant. But then Richard's grandmother was a giant, so maybe it skipped the generation, you know.
How difficult was it researching somebody who always was changing their backstory and kind of, I hate to use the word lying, but let's say inventing new stories about himself all the time?
Well, he did less of that than he just refused to talk about stuff. He never talked about his childhood with me, really. He'd give an occasional allusion to stuff, like one night we were out chasing nightcrawlers on the lawn. He told me he used to sell nightcrawlers, you know, as a kid. And so there was that going on, It was a great revelation to, like, pry, you know. He would have hated it. I mean, he was so secretive and so, you know, so compartmentalized in the way he arranged his friendships. So, you know, I got all the girlfriends to spill the beans to me, and he would have hated that. But I don't know how much lying he ever did about his past, you know. He just didn't talk about it at all.
Just kind of the fictionalization, you know, via the stories and everything. I love that you pull in quotes from his own stories and poems and everything.
Fiction is fiction, but I that was a great revelation to me. I was a fan of Richard's work. And I always thought that the concepts and the books themselves were as made up as his fantastic metaphors, you know, these wild reaches into language. And when I got digging into his life, I began to see that in one way or another, everything Richard ever wrote about was semi-autobiographical, I guess. And I guess that applies to all writers, really, if you dig deep enough. But, you know, with Richard's stuff, I was just amazed. I mean, you know, he wrote a book about bondage, and gosh, guess what? He was really into bondage, and I wasn't trying to be Kitty Kelly, so I wouldn't have even concerned myself with bondage, except he wrote about it. Mm-hmm. And since this is a literary biography, and I'm trying to talk about the life of a writer, an artist, and where did his art come from, then suddenly the bondage was fair game. And on down the line, you know, I mean, every one of those books connects to Richard's life in some way or other. I mean, trout fishing, my God, it was almost all true. I mean, he and Ginny actually went on that trip to the Stanley Basin. The notes he took in his notebooks are all stuff that he did. He also kept a side notebook where he talked about every fish he caught. You know, he kept a big list. Richard was a great counter. He was always counting things. And he had a character in Hawkline Monster who's a counter. I think it's Cameron, who's always counting passing fence posts and the number of cows in a field. Well, Richard once counted all the punctuation in Ecclesiastes. You know, I mean, he really did that. You know, I found notebooks with listings of punctuations. He'd draw, you know, lines down the page vertically, and on the top he'd put periods, commas, semicolons, blah, blah, blah. And then he'd write page one, and he'd start recording them. He'd actually enumerate the punctuation, and totally wacky, isn't it?
Yeah, that's a little OCD. My goodness.
Yeah, yeah. Confederate General is all true. That just astonished me when I interviewed Price Dunn, who was, in fact, the model for Lee Mellon. You know, all that stuff, the guy with the suitcase full of securities, the crocodile, the little baby alligator, whatever, in the frog pond. It was all real.
Kind of getting back into your screenwriting career a little bit, how did you get involved adapting the Hawkline Monster?
Well, you know, I knew a lot of the players, so to speak, and Richard had written a big draft, and, you know, for Hal Ashby, and the original casting was going to be Harry Dean Stanton and Jack Nicholson. And then it was going to be Jack Nicholson and Dustin Hoffman. And the way these things work, you know, these guys, they filter in and filter out, and it just never quite came to pass. And then Hal Ashby got sick. And so Hal Ashby stepped back and made himself like the producer, you know. He was no longer, you know, didn't have the strength to see it through as a director. And this fellow named Mike Haller, who was an old buddy of mine, I met him on Rancho Deluxe, and he came out with his family, and they got to be friends with Richard, and he was the art director, and he was Hal Ashby's art director for almost all of his movies, starting with the one about Bud Cort, Harold and Maude. So, you know, and naturally, like everybody that does a lesser task, everyone wants to direct, and so Mike Haller was going to be the director, and right at that time, I was just living in L.A. Always in a hotel, though. I would never go so far as to rent an apartment because I didn't want it to seem like I actually lived there. You know, if you're in a hotel, you really live in Montana, but you're just stuck in this hotel because that's where they want you to be. And I was working on Legend, and the thing is that it was one of those points which happened two or three times where Legend just completely blew apart because of internal friction. It just blew asunder, and it was dead in the water. And, you know, I remember coming into the office after it blew apart, and Peter Beale, who was then the producer, was sitting with his door open, his door was never open. He was always on the phone. He's sitting there, he's got his big custom-made shoes up on the desk, and he's in his custom-made suit, and he kind of crooks his finger at me, and I come in, you know. And so I just sort of said, well, you know, what should I do today, Peter? And he said, I suggest you do what I'm going to do, old Beam. Look for a job. So I put out the word, and there was, you know, I actually, it's odd, you know, I look back and I think, God, I thought it would go on forever. Of course, it didn't. But, you know, there was a period sort of in the mid-80s when I was actually a fairly hot commodity as a screenwriter. you know, I just kept getting assignments, you know, offered to me. And it didn't take but like 2 weeks to line up. And I had two offers, both out of Universal. One was to write something for David Giler that was, he had only a title, Spartacus in Space. And the other one was to do Hawkline Monster. So I chose to do Hawkline Monster because I thought, well, you know, I know Mike Haller, he's a friend, and I've met Ashby a couple of times, and Richard's a buddy, and, you know, so how hard can this be? And one thing led to another, and Mike Haller wouldn't talk to me for a couple of years. You know, I mean, it just was, we ended up like stuck in, and I can say he's deceased now, I don't want to speak ill of the dead, I really liked him a lot, but we would sit there, and our producer, you know, who was just the exec, not the main, you know, he was just the guy, you know, the studio guy meant to oversee the project, called it Dueling Desks. And I'd sit there writing, rewriting and writing, and he's at the next desk, and I would write a page or rewrite a page and hand it to him. And without saying a word, he'd start crossing stuff out with a big red pen. You know, and so, like, the tension just built to the point where it was just, it was like a pressure cooker in there. And it all ended one day when, you know, Chinich, that was the name of the executive, was over, and he and Michael are arguing about some aspect of this rewrite. And at that point, you know, I'm just sitting there saying, when can I get out of here? It's already 8 o'clock at night, and I've been here all day, you know, and I just want to go back to my hotel room, veg out with the TV. And so Chinich turns to me and says, well, what do you think about this, Gatz? And I said, what do you care what I think? I'm just the word processor in this operation. And then later that night, there was a knock at the door, and it was Chinich. He came to him right to the door, and he said, we're in big trouble here. And I said, well, tell me about it. And he said, you know, and he said, well, the script is light, it's airless. What happened to all the humor? And I said, well, you know, Michael says he hates jokes, and he crosses anything out that is remotely meant to be humorous. And what can I say? You know, he's the boss. And he said, no, he's not really the boss. You know, Universal's the boss, and he's paying both of you guys. And he said, if I said you could go back home to Montana, what would you say? I'd say, when is the next flight? He said, I know you're due to start back. And then Legend had revived in the course of like 3 or 4 months. And I was set to go to London in about 3 weeks. And so he said, well, if I told you that, you know, you could go home right away, would you do me a favor? Would you just take, you know, the structure of the new draft, put back into it some of the stuff from the first draft that was funny? And I said, sure. So I did that, you know, I did that. And then I took off for London. And what happened, I think I put it in the book, what happened was the guy that was the head of production, motion picture production, Universal, then was a guy named Tom Mount. I don't know if that rings a bell. His first name is spelled T-H-O-M, Tom Mount. And he's got his own production company now. But anyway, so on a Friday, Haller and Chinich are busy Xeroxing up, you know, dozens of copies of the finally, you know, neatly typed, you know, this version with the new structure and some of the old material reinserted. And they're, you know, they take some couple copies in and they put them neatly in the center of Tom Mount's desk for him to look at Monday morning. So Mount drives in, and this building at Universal is called the Black Tower. It's this like 8-story glass building that is mostly lawyers figuring out how to screw everybody. And top two floors are the executives. And so here comes, so Tom Mount drives in, and here's his parking space. And his parking space is full with all his stuff. His cardboard boxes full of his photos and his memento. So he storms upstairs, and basically the guard won't let him in the building. And that's how he found out he was fired. And so his successor was a guy named Frank Rich, and what they always do, like anything touched by your predecessor is now poison. So every green-lighted, you know, development project that Tom Mount had put his imprimatur on, Frank Rich is threw into the wastebasket. So no one even read this script at Universal.
I'm always fascinated by unmade films.
Well, I got a million of those kind of stories because I've worked on about 30 projects.
Right.
And you know how many of them actually got made.
Yeah, because Legend changed dramatically, didn't it? Between...
Oh, if you looked at the first draft, which was called Legend of Darkness, Well, I'll tell you how much the one way you know how much it changed was there was a woman named Marcia Nassiter who was then pushing 70, but she was the first really big shot female executive in the studio system in Hollywood, and she was attached to this picture then, I think, because it was both Universal and Fox were mixed up in it. You know, Universal for North America and Fox for the rest of the world. And so we had offices there, actually a couple of trailers at Fox. And so we had our first big meeting after, you know, and Ridley, had, when he read the first draft, he goes, "It's a hole-in-one." And I was so naive. I thought they're just going to go make it, you know, just the way it is. Little did I know, like 15 drafts later. But so we're in this meeting, and Marcia Nassiter is a chain smoker, and she's got this emphysematous cough, and she's hacking away. You know, and she said, "Well, there's absolutely one thing that must come out of this screenplay." And I'm, of course, a little humble writer busily taking notes. She goes, "You can't have the villain the princess." And I went, "Okay." And at that moment, my whole notion of taking a fairy tale idea and going as dark with it as possible and really, you know, dipping into the grimmest of the Butt Brothers grim, you know, that just began to go out the window. And so everything that happened ever thereafter was all done by me. I figured better me than somebody else because it was my story. And somehow the arc of the story sort of remained the same. The ring in the pond, the unicorn, eternal winter, you know, all that stuff. So, but it was a lot darker, and that went out the window.
It's funny to look at your filmography and see all these projects that were you had done the screenwriting that either came to be or never came to be, but just to see that you had taken shots at Legend of the Fall and River Runs Through It. It's just
I did the first drafts of both of those projects, but they were both for studios that didn't make the movie. What would happen is they would, you know, like whoever hired me would get fired, and then the new guy would look at this thing and say, "What? A movie about trout fishing?" And it would go in the trash can. They wouldn't renew the option. And if you don't own the film rights to the underlying material, the screenplay is just dead as a dinosaur.
I'd be very curious to read your Mandrake the Magician, too.
Oh, that was a really good script. It was. And the funny thing is like the good ones, if they float around long enough, people like cherry pick them. And you find little bits and pieces of all of your screenplays, like showing up in other movies. For example, there was a movie called Minority Report, Spielberg, Tom Cruise, and it didn't have anything that was story-wise or character-wise like anything I wrote, but I had done a kind of futuristic detective story, and it had all of my gizmos, you know, all of the stuff, you know, the way the newspaper, you know, all of that was stolen from, lifted from, I don't know, stolen, maybe a strong word, but someone, and I know that this writer, one of the writers, had access to this screenplay of mine, and he just, like, he just took all the, because, you know, it took months to figure out how do you make, you know, a project that's, you know, like, it's actually John Davidson's expression, $1 into the future. That's what he called RoboCop. So I love that expression. So I was trying to do a story that was $1 into the future. In other words, you can film it in the warehouse district of Seattle on a rainy night. But there's stuff, the gizmos, people have stuff. And that stuff is so different that you think, oh, yes, this must be the future. Minority Report took every one of those things. But you can't copy, you know, you can't protect ideas. That's the way it works, is you can't protect ideas, but it's all about ideas. Or right now, I guess, the lack of ideas, you know, I would suppose.
What was that script that Minority?
Oh, I, you know, it's still halfway in play, and I don't even want to say the name of it for fear that the vultures will pick at the bones even more.
My usual question to somebody that's written a book, especially something as monumental as Jubilee Hitchhiker, is, you know, how it's being received, but it's only been out for just a few weeks now, officially.
Yeah, so far so good. You know, I mean, I've had mostly West Coast reviews. I did a little, it was very grueling. I did it by car, put 4,000 miles in the car. My wife and I, we started in Seattle, and we did this little mini West Coast reading tour, which was less about selling books. I actually got to read at City Lights, which was a great kick for me, and I packed the poetry room, and that was a lot of fun, but it was fairly grueling, you know, 4,000 miles in 3 weeks, and endless motel rooms, and this and that. There was a review in the Oregonian, and there was just recently popped up a review in the Chronicle. So both of these reviews were, I would say, very, very positive, but the only thing they chose to chide me for was how big it was, which is, sort to me, sort of like saying, gee, isn't that the Empire State Building? It's a beautiful building, but it's really a little tall, don't you think? You know, it's kind of big. Isn't that sort of a big building? You know, so I don't get it. You know, it's like saying, hey, Leo, maybe if you left out the peace part, that your book wouldn't have to be so long. Again, my saying is, it is what it is, and if each chapter is readable and it makes you want to read the next chapter, so it just takes you a little longer to read it, but if you enjoy the whole thing, what is there to complain about, except in this age of texting, you know, where things are becoming ever more abbreviated? On the plus side, J.K. Rowling taught us that 8- and 9-year-olds will read 700-page books, and a whole mess of them, too. So I'm not completely discouraged about the fact that it's long, you know. And in a way, it's my little ironic joke on Richard, who was so, whose books and stories and poems were so short. You know, I'm saying, well, take this, Richard. Here's a great big fatty with every one of your secrets, or as many as I could find, like laid out, you know, for everyone to look at.
It is a little bit of a risk killer.
I know. Well, you can get it on Kindle, and then you can blow the type up. And, of course, it gets even longer when you do that. Well, imagine you were trapped on a rainy summer in a rented house in Maine and you couldn't do any of the fun things you wanted to do, but by God, there were 500 New Yorkers, old New Yorkers, in the attic. Well, I just figure you could sit down with a certain amount of pleasure and read your way through those 500 New Yorkers, and it wouldn't seem like an ordeal. That's what I think of as this book. It's sort of like 500 New Yorkers stacked side by side. And the best review that has so far, you know, the East Coast, of course, they never paid much attention to Richard either, oddly enough. No one has noticed there. Do you know what I mean? There's yet to be a murmuring from any East Coast publication, and maybe it won't happen. But there was a review in this magazine called Booklist, which apparently turns out to be the American Library Association's, you know, in-house, you know, publication. And the reviews are very short, sort of like Kirkus and Publishers Weekly, so they're just a couple of paragraphs long, but it was an absolute unqualified rave. I was just thrilled. Plus, it got a star. You know, I felt like I was in the third grade, and Mrs. Bronson, you know, put a little gold star on my crayon drawing. Yeah, so I got a starred review, and so I'm only hoping, I mean, people have told me that this is the publication that all the librarians of America base their orders upon. So I'm hoping that, you know, like if just 1 in 100 of America's libraries buys this book, that'll be good. You know, the thing is like you can only go so far with the book, and then it's in print, and then people tell you about the mistakes, and you hope it makes it to a second printing so you can clean up the mistakes officially, which will happen in the paperback no matter what, but I hope it, you know, gets a second printing. But I don't know. It's beyond, you know what I mean? It's sort of beyond my control now. I'm done. There's nothing more I can do to the book except I'll go any place that people want me to go, and I'll read, you know, and I'll go on the radio, and I'll talk to people who want to talk about it. But there's nothing more I can do, and I know, even my son so told me a Richard story. People will be telling me Richard stories till the day I die. But I don't care. I don't care. Too late now. The book is finished. I'm not going to continually go back and amend it because I've heard another story. And I'm giddy with a sense of new freedom. It's like having walked for 100 miles with a backpack full of rocks. And then when you take off I feel like a helium balloon. You know, I'm just floating off the surface. You know, all of my major responsibilities are done. And I may have a vow now. I'll never again take an advance for a product that's not finished. Never. I don't want that. I just don't want it, you know, to owe something to somebody. I don't mind writing them and then try to sell them and then get a contract, but not to have, you know, the way people do, oh, you get a 3-book contract and then you owe them too. You know, I don't want to do that. I learned my lesson with this.
This is Alfredo Garcia. He's about to become a very important man.
We are looking for an old buddy of ours, a compadre named Alfredo Garcia.
A private army is scouring 3 countries to find Alfredo Garcia.
Well, don't worry, if he's alive, I'll find him.
Alive isn't our problem.
Someone has offered $1 million for his head.
If I ever get my hands on him, I'm going to kill him.
All we'll ever require from you
is physical proof that Garcia is dead.
And we're prepared to settle for his head.
Bring me the head of Alfredo Garcia. This man will become an animal.
Alfredo's our saint. He's a saint of our money.
I'll take it to him.
I love you. This woman's dreams of love will be destroyed.
I've been here before. You don't know the way.
Innocent people will suffer.
With Alfredo's help, we can do anything, honey.
Holy ground will be desecrated.
You don't want me to be part of that, do you?
You are a part of it.
25 people will die.
Just being together is enough.
No, it's not, baby.
All because of Alfredo Garcia. And only one man really knows why.
Kill him.
Sam Peckinpah, director of the greatest adventure films of our time, has made possibly his most powerful and startling motion picture.
Beyond the darkness, beyond the human evolution, is Khan, a genetically superior tyrant. Exiled to a barren planet, banished by a starship commander he is destined to destroy. Left for dead, he has survived.
I'll chase him round the moons of Nibia and round the Antares maelstrom and round perdition's flames before I give him up.
There she is.
Shield's collapsing, Captain.
Can you give me phaser power?
A few shots, sir.
Not enough against their shields.
The base is stubborn.
Scotty, I need warp speed in 3 minutes or we're all dead.
I've done far worse than kill you. I've hurt you. And I wish to go on hurting you. I shall leave you as you left me. Marooned for all eternity. Buried alive. Buried alive.
Khan! Khan!
At the end of the universe lies the beginning of vengeance. Star Trek II. The Wrath of Khan. Opens at a theater near you.
Hello, LA!
A rock star is dead.
Bobby!
A groupie has disappeared, and millions are missing.
I think that somebody's trying to rip my company off.
Those were his kind of odds. His name? Ford Fairlane.
Hey, it's Ford Fairlane!
Hey, what are your names, Neil and Bob? Is that like what you do, huh?
A detective who's so smooth.
What is it they call you?
Precocious. Combustionable.
He's aerodynamic.
Hey.
Cool. Everyone knows him.
Hey, you're that guy. The private eye.
You're a poet and didn't know it.
Everyone owes him.
Take this, Ford.
Well, money's fine, really. I need cash, moolah, wampum, dead presidents, Michael Jackson, Gerald Ford.
See, that's the difference between a great investigator like me and a piece of spam like you.
Spam?
And nothing they say.
You're a piece of spam. That's what I think of you.
Can throw him.
Mr. Fairlane, when I was 11, I walked in on my father and the Shetland pony he gave me for my 10th birthday. Does that excite you?
I don't know. I never met your father.
But this case can put him back.
I don't need money.
In the black.
I need questions answered. Question number one. Can I have some money?
But when your beat is the music business,
let me see this chick around.
Is this a trick question?
You keep notes on everyone.
Got you.
Priscilla Presley.
Who?
I wouldn't trust that babe as far as I could bowl her.
Ed O'Neill.
Booty tag. Booty tag.
Robert Englund. Tone Loc. Gilbert Gottfried. Sheila E. And Wayne Newton.
What?
Yes, Wayne Newton.
And I gotta defeat a baby.
Oh, he seems nice.
Andrew Dice Clay.
Oh!
Is Ford Fairlane.
Shall I drive his main?
In a movie so hot.
Got something cooking in the microwave?
Get out!
You'd better bring protection.
Oh, maybe it was just a pot pie.
Ford Fairlane.
Are you mad?
No, I'm ecstatic.
Coming in July to theaters everywhere.
On the 13th floor of a corporate tower, a team of scientists have created a portal to a simulated universe. Now, after 6 years of testing, they are about to cross the boundaries of reality.
So the whole thing's what, a giant computer game?
Nothing so mundane, man. When my mind is jacked in and I'm walking around experiencing 1937, my body stays here and kind of holds the consciousness of the program link unit.
They thought they could maintain control.
You can't just keep plugging your brain into this machine and not expect to be affected.
But once they opened the door...
Isn't this great?
These people are real.
Is this real?
The experiment turned on them.
You think one of them units crawled up an extension cord and killed its maker?
Then why didn't they kill you?
Maybe they will.
Saying that there's another world on top of this one?
That's right. We're nothing but a simulation on some computer.
So who's in control?
Not us.
You could call it the end of the world.
Doesn't exist.
Hey, what'd you do to the world?
Turned it off.
Tell me about it, eh?
What's that?
What happened? I want to know everything you saw and heard. Everything.
Monica.
Come on now, come along.
Take go of me! And I beg you, Ranieri. She's my wife.
Excuse me.
Monica, speak to me. What happened?
Please, you're tiring her.
Monica. Oh. Dear, who did it? Who?
Run through it over and over again. I can't get it out of my head, but I can't manage to pin it down either.
Let me finish. He isn't even Italian, and you're making him risk his life. Somebody's already tried to kill him once.
Julia.
And what makes you so sure they won't try again? You're blackmailing him.